wish I was the monster you think I am. I wish I had enough poison for the whole pack of you.
Anything can be a slam poem if you say it like this.
Do you think I'm a hypocrite? Well, you should.
So the name of the character is Matt LeBlanc, and I have to audition?
Vissy, I have a job. I have people who count on me. I don't have time to come running down to the White House at your beck and call like you're the only one who's important. Sitting down is not happening. So what do you want?
Just a little taste from the Emmy nominees this year. The 66th annual Primetime Emmy Awards ceremony is tonight, beginning at 5 o'clock. Old favorites like Mad Men and Breaking Bad are up for all sorts of awards. Louie and The Big Bang Theory, too. But can an upstart like Orange is the New Black or Silicon Valley take home the prize? Our guides through all of this today are Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi there.
Hey there.
And Mary McNamara, TV critic for The LA Times. Welcome.
Hello.
All right, let's start with the horse race itself. The best actor category is really tough this year. We've got Mad Men's Jon Hamm, Breaking Bad's Bryan Cranston, and here's a little bit from the leads of True Detective, both up for the Best Actor Emmy.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
It means I'm bad at parties.
Let me tell you, you ain't great outside of parties either.
Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, of course. So, Mary, who is the favorite to take it home tonight?
Well, I think Matthew McConaughey is the favorite. I mean, obviously, this is the last time to honor Bryan Cranston for, you know, the groundbreaking performance in Breaking Bad. But he has won before, and we're never going to get a chance to possibly give an Emmy to Matthew McConaughey. So I think that that's pretty much a shoe-in.
And what do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I think if anything, Breaking Bad's kind of out of sight, out of mind at this point. One of the greatest shows of all time, but we've kind of forgotten about it. Meanwhile, Matthew McConaughey can do no wrong right now. I think if he was up for the Nobel Peace Prize, he would probably win it. So I think he'll be up on stage tonight saying, all right, all right, all right, one more time.
Okay. And okay, so that's the best drama category. Let's play a little music right now in the background while we discuss. Of course, one of my favorites, Downton Abbey, up against Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, True Detective. Michael.
Yeah, you're not going to be hearing that theme song tonight.
I'm sorry.
But, you know, I really think I'm going on a ledge here, and I think this could be the year that Game of Thrones takes it.
Really?
Right during the voting process, Game of Thrones turned into such a phenomenon this summer. And I think, if anything, you know, a lot of people are still saying Breaking Bad because it was the final year, but there could be a lot of Breaking Bad fans who are also True Detective fans. So those two shows may cancel each other out, and I think Game of Thrones, such a phenomenon right now, and that would be such a game-changing vote. So I'm picking that.
And Mary, the Emmy Awards, do they usually go to these old war horses who have seen their last seasons, or do they usually go to reward the new ones, which are really popular?
You know, I think usually is not a word we can use anymore. I mean, everything in television has changed so much. There are so many shows that deserve Emmys that it's like there are no patterns anymore. I mean, I certainly hope that Game of Thrones wins. It is, in my opinion, the best TV show on right now. It's so ambitious and never seems to put a foot wrong. So I hope this is its year.
Yeah, but yet, Madeline, we always see we come into the Emmys with these big hopes that new blood will win, but then they a lot of times,
yeah.
You know, Modern Family seems to win it every year. I hope this is the year that Orange is the New Black actually picks it up, and I think it's going to. That's my pick to click. But then again, I would not be shocked if Breaking Bad and Modern Family won yet again this year.
Yet again. And Modern Family wins all the time, it seems, in the comedy category.
You know, we've seen this through the years. You know, Frasier won so many times through the years as well. And actually, if Modern Family wins this year, it'll break Frasier's record.
Who actually votes in these categories? And do they actually watch the entire season?
Well,
that's the problem, I think. It's that, you know, it's impossible. You can't watch every episode of every series. I mean, even I can't, and I watch television for a living. So they're basically voting on like one or two episodes, which is like, you know, voting for an Oscar based on the movie's trailer.
And star power does play into it. So, you know, that's why McConaughey is going to win. And we've seen other people in the past from the film world who come into the Emmys and win because they're still film stars.
And what about campaigning? Mary, does that play a big role?
Well, I think you're seeing it play a bigger role. I mean, the Emmy campaigns have really stepped up in the last couple of years as attention has been increasingly paid to television. We'll see whether it actually pays off in terms of the gold, but I think it is getting into the conversation, which I think is a big part, too, because you have so many shows. I feel like the Academy members often have to rely on, well, what shows are people talking about? Maybe they're the shows that should win.
Okay, let's talk about the show itself. For the first time in a very long time, they are on a Monday night, and that's because the Emmys deferred to the VMAs, which were on last night.
Yeah, you know, it was a blinking contest, and the Emmys blinked for good reason. Let's be honest, the VMAs would outperform the Emmys. The VMAs is a much more entertaining event. It does very well every year, whereas the Emmys, it's a slog. It's not a really entertaining broadcast. They have to give out 26 awards on that show. So, you know, if you're a TV fan, you watch, but you're not watching the Emmys for big entertaining content.
So no Blue Ivy.
The biggest surprise at the Emmys this year may be whether people actually make it through the traffic to the ceremony.
Right.
Yeah, Emmygeddon.
Yeah, no. Emmygeddon. Right, because it's downtown during rush hour.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
All right. Last year, they ran a slideshow and even standalone tributes to celebrities who died. And that was really criticized as a clunky presentation. Are they planning on doing the same thing?
Well, I think they thought it was kind of dour last year because they did these mini tributes to five different folks. This year, there is going to be a big tribute to Robin Williams for good reason, and Billy Crystal is going to host that. And I think people are really looking forward to that. But I think they're always aware of the criticism and what happened last year. So I don't think it'll be a downer like maybe it was last year.
Last year was like the I See Dead People Emmys. So
yeah.
We're really hoping that it won't be that this year.
Okay, well, let's talk about the hosting. Seth Meyers is behind the podium this year, and here he is managing expectations.
With me, it's all about having really good jokes, so hired really good joke writers, and hopefully we'll have a fun monologue. That's sort of my strength. I can't sing or dance, so that's a sneak peek I will get you, is there will be no singing or dancing.
Wow, okay. Not a big vote for ambition there, but what do you think? I mean, do you think he might be a good host?
Well, he has a lot of friends in the audience, so that'll be good. I mean, Amy Poehler is always good about mixing things up. Julie Louis-Dreyfus is always good about, you know, they'll pull these stunts at the shows. And so I'm hoping that he will have enlisted some of his co-stars, because those are the shows, the Emmy telecasts, that work the best. Like Jimmy Fallon's show, famously, was great because he had that opener with all of the nominees singing and dancing.
Yeah, these are tough shows to do. But, you know, Seth has hosted a number of award shows. He's done the ESPYs a couple of times. He did the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Mm-hmm. So he knows how to do a show like this. But these are tough shows because, again, you've got those 26 awards you got to hand out. So the entertainment bar is low.
So where would you rank it in terms of Oscars, Golden Globes, doing your laundry?
In terms of watchability?
Yeah.
It's tough because, you know, the Oscars is one thing. You know, they give out a lot of awards there, too. But there's something that's still sort of, you know, really pomp and circumstance about that. The Grammys is just a fun show because it's all about musical talent, and they barely give any awards away. VMAs, you're watching to see who's going to get drunk or do something stupid on air. And then Golden Globes, they are all drunk. So you're watching to see who's going to, you know, really make an embarrassment of themselves by the end of the show. So the Emmys, really tough to compare. To all those.
What do you think, Mary?
Well, I think what the Emmys has going for it is it's made by people who make TV. And so I think if they let themselves make good TV, then it'll be great. It's when they kind of fall into the, oh, we're going to be as serious as the Oscars, that they get into trouble.
Okay, well, here's hoping for some fun tonight. Mary McNamara, TV critic for the LA Times, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Always great to have you.
As always, Madeline.
All right, so who are you pulling for this year? Are you a die-hard Breaking Bad fan? Do you think True Detective deserves it? Give us a call with your picks, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Well, as we mentioned, the Emmys were upstaged by the Video Music Awards last night, but there was plenty of drama even before the VMAs began. Singer Chris Brown's Saturday night VMA party at a Hollywood nightclub turned into chaos when shots were fired, and it appears the target was Suge Knight, the controversial hip-hop producer and record executive. He was hit by several bullets but managed to walk out of the club and into a sheriff's car. He's expected to survive. No arrests have been made, but this is not the first first time Suge Knight has been involved in a shooting. He was driving the car when Tupac Shakur was gunned down 18 years ago in Las Vegas. To take a closer look at Suge Knight and his role in the music world, we're joined by Jake Brown, author of Suge Knight, The Rise, Fall, and Rise of Death Row Records. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, he founded Death Row Records, but he's been in and out of prison and shot at several times in his life. How was he able to build a successful record label while at the same time being involved in real-life serious crimes?
That's a fascinating question, and it's one of the unique kind of fine lines Suge has walked with one foot very authentically in the gang world and one very authentically in the record world. And he sort of fused that for the first time through the label, through the way, you know, way that Snoop was an active gang member, Snoop Dogg, one of the artists that Suge discovered, Dr. Dre, and his music videos. They were, you know, it was just a whole new culture that Suge introduced as part of Death Row Records that made gangster rap really mainstream for the first time. And unfortunately, you know, that's cut both ways. It's contributed to his celebrity still maintaining itself, but also he becomes, you know, a target of these kind of shootings. He was also shot in 2007. At a Kanye West release party in the lake. So it's
also pre-VMAs, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
And then he's been rumored, it's been rumored, nothing proven, that he was involved in the murder of Biggie Smalls.
Well, you know, that is an interesting conundrum that'll stay one, because there's a very, very, and Suge is a part of that. He said so in a Nightline interview when they asked him about Tupac's murder. If he knew who did it, would he tell the police? He said absolutely not. There's a culture within that, that more of the urban-based kind of gangster world of keeping, you know, your mouth shut, whether no matter what side you're on. And so with Biggie, that was a rumor that was substantiated to some point through a lawsuit that Loretta Wallace, Biggie's mother, filed. But again, the case was dismissed. It's never been clearly, you know, laid out, but he's definitely been, you know, named as a unofficially as a suspect by the LAPD at different points. They've just never been able to connect him to it directly. So that one's, you know, kind of left to the urban legends, if you will, you know. But.
And another urban legend that he may have been involved, strangely, even though he was driving the car in the death of Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wrote a book with the Shakur estate and interviewed all of the principals that were there when that happened, and you know, off the record as well as on the record, it just was never something that was really believed within his circle, because, you know, Suge got Tupac out for the last 8 months of his life. They made 180 songs, he shot 2 movies, 18 videos, it secured this Tupac Shakur legacy, which is something else Suge Knight does not get credit for, and the fact he was the only one within that industry that would take a chance and bail Tupac out and put up the insurance bonds, and I interviewed Johnny J extensively as producer on all of that music, and Suge and Tupac were like brothers. So I then putting himself in the line of fire. It's a lot of conjecture, but that's never really been substantiated the same way the Biggie allegation has had a little more teeth to it.
So how was he able to become so successful? I know he first broke out with Dr. Dre, but how was he able to turn this music into a worldwide phenomenon?
Well, it's interesting you ask. Suge Knight, without Suge Knight, there would be no Sean Combs and Bad Boy and by extension Biggie. There would be no Jay-Z and Roc Nation. There would be no Cash Money Records. Suge was the first, and it's just been acknowledged industry-wide, the first African-American hip-hop indie label owner, independent company, completely owned their master catalog, didn't have a production deal where the, you know, the parent label, Jimmy Iovine, of course, who now is Beats with, you know, Beats by Dre and all of these amazing things they go on to do. They got Interscope out of bankruptcy when they signed Death Row. So Suge was the first guy to do that. And then also his artist, Snoop Dogg, he discovered, you know, Tupac, we just discussed, was getting that big chunk of music out before he passed. Unfortunately, Dr. Dre getting him out of this contract that let him go on and achieve everything he did entrepreneurially. So he really, his success was, you know, he had a quote once, he said, it doesn't matter how controversial you are, as long as you have money coming in, they'll deal with you. And that, I always thought, was one of the most insightful things that he, you know, had to kind of say on that subject, because there was so much controversy at the same time that surrounded them. And then you could also argue that the controversy fueled the record sales and almost legitimized, oddly enough, you know what I mean, all of that trouble was something people were attracted to because it made money, it was flashy, it was a whole new era for videos and unfortunately real life kind of imitated art.
Yeah. Well, so he definitely had a business sense. Did he also have an eye for talent? Was he able to?
Well, sure. Yeah. Little Bow Wow. He discovered, obviously Snoop was a Suge signing. The DOC, who unfortunately had a tragic auto accident and couldn't rap anymore, he put him on as a writer, and he helped write Nothing But a G Thing and some huge hip hop hits. you know, yeah, Shug's eye for talent is probably one of the things that he's also not very credited for because of all the controversy. But there would be no Snoop Dogg without Shug Knight. Just as one example, that's a huge piece of hip hop culture right there that would be missing. You know, think what you want of Little Bow Wow in terms of, but he has had a very successful career as an actor, etc. So yeah, his eye as a talent scout is one of his biggest assets at that point.
But yet some of his big artists turned against him, Snoop for one, Dr. Dre for another.
Unfortunately, that too has been substantiated. There was huge lawsuits at the Shakur estate that, you know, they were awarded co-ownership of all those masters due to financial impropriety. So it was all kinds of things. When he went to prison, to be fair, and he didn't have his finger on the pulse every day because he was such a micromanager, he was legendary for working 36 hours before he'd sleep and constantly running that company and managing all those artists too at the same time. When he went to prison, that, you know, the label really, Snoop Dogg was left with a $1 million tax bill and went to sign with Master P's No Limit. Dr. Dre, of course, left the label. A lot of people just couldn't financially stay because the books were in such disarray. And because he was so much the guy with his finger on the trigger when he was gone, everything kind of went to...
So now Death Row is in bankruptcy?
Now it's a trustee asset of, a holding company in New York that just buys publishing catalogs. I mean, they have the reissues of all of the Chronic and everything online, but, you know... you can buy all that music, but they haven't put a new record out since album called Dysfunctional Family, which was the only release that Shug put out post-prison in 2001 before he went bankrupt. So no, they really, after the 90s, they never really got back on their feet after that kind of a... He still had quite a bit of money from his catalog, but he lost that in the bankruptcy too, you know, that he had to file with Death Row. So really, it's just those hits from the 90s are so timeless, though, and those stars became such legacy stars that's really where his legacy is as a record man, you know, in discovering or freeing these artists to lead these hugely successful careers that follow their initial, you know. And unfortunately, you can analogize it to the Johnny Fontaine Godfather, you know, sort of story a little bit, you know, with some of his tactics. But there's a double-edged sword of that, obviously, for him. It's cut both ways.
Jake Brown, he is a music writer and author of the book Shug Knight, The Rise, Fall, and Rise of Death Row Records. His latest book is Nashville Songwriters, coming out next month. Jake, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Tupac Shakur's Troublesome. Coming up, the transformation of Afghanistan's capital from boomtown to ghost town. Just 4 years ago, Kabul was known as Kabubble. The city was awash in money and Westerners seeking their fortunes. Now, a wave of violence has forced many to leave. And along with the military withdrawal, Kabul is now more like a ghost town. That story coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. A new Afghan president was supposed to take over from Hamid Karzai today, but the election's been delayed by fraud and violence. And it's one sign of how, in a pretty short time, even Afghanistan's safest places have become war zones. A few years ago, the country's capital, Kabul, was known as the Kabubble. Billions of dollars flowed into the city. Diplomats, aid workers, journalists flocked there for career-making jobs, fat paychecks, and a decadent social scene. But in the past year and a half, dozens of expats have been killed as militants expand their attacks. Matthew Akins is a magazine writer based in Kabul. His latest story, Last Tango in Kabul, is in the current issue of Rolling Stone, and the article traces the city's rise and fall. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, earlier this month, headline-making news, Major General Harold Green was shot by an Afghan soldier in Kabul, and he was the highest-ranking officer to be killed since the 9/11 terrorist attacks. What's been the reaction in Kabul to his death?
Well, these kind of high-profile attacks really give people a sense that they can happen anywhere, even in the most secured locations, and that further limits the contact that foreigners are having with Afghans, particularly with the military.
But you're writing mainly in your article about civilians being targeted, and you write that the major turning point happened with a massacre at a restaurant called La Taverna. Tell us about that. What happened, and why was that so frightening to so many people there?
Well, the thing that people have to understand is that Kabul was never like Baghdad. It wasn't that you had this green zone under siege with everyone living in heavily fortified compounds. Actually, despite the fact that there was a war going on in the rest of the country, within Kabul, a lot of foreigners felt safe enough to live in unguarded houses and go out to dinner at restaurants. And while that had been slowly eroding over the years, at the beginning of this year, you know, there was still a thriving restaurant scene, for example. So what happened was a team of suicide attackers broke into the restaurant and killed 21 people before being killed themselves. And this was a place that all of us had gone to at one point or another. It was a popular Lebanese restaurant. So that, I think, was a bit of a watershed in shaking people's confidence that the city was safe anymore.
And then a few days later, a Swedish radio journalist was killed.
Well, he was just shot while he was standing in the street, and it wasn't clear why. It still isn't clear why. Someone just came up and shot him dead. Nothing like this had really ever happened in Kabul before. So people weren't sure whether this was a targeted attack, but if that was the case, then it was strange because he had just been in the country a few days and wasn't reporting anything sensitive, or if people were just stalking the street looking for foreigners to kill, in which case, you know, that's a sort of new kind of threat in the city.
But you interviewed a spokesman with the Taliban who said the Taliban didn't take responsibility for it, but this is part of their overall agenda, is to target now civilian workers, Westerners.
Yeah, well, the Taliban have always maintained the invasion, as they call it, as a civilian as well as military component. And in a sense, they're not wrong, because one of the things we've seen in this war is that the military has used development work and reconstruction work as part of its campaign, right? This counterinsurgency campaign to win hearts and minds. They've built bridges and clinics and schools. So there's been a very problematic association of civilian aid efforts with the military mission here.
Since 2001, some $700 billion in American tax money has been spent in Afghanistan. And was there a situation where so much money was washing around in Kabul that a lot of it ended up maybe unaccounted for or being spent in inappropriate ways?
I think there's no question that this war is one of the greatest boondoggles in American history, if not the greatest. I mean, they spent more money than was spent on the Marshall Plan for rebuilding Germany and Japan after World War II. And the money has actually been counterproductive in a lot of ways because it's so thoroughly corrupted the Afghan government.
And did it also contribute to this kabubble that you describe in Kabul, where a lot of foreigners were, you know, living a high life?
They absolutely were. I mean, you know, I write in the piece that people could basically class jump. You know, they could come here, work jobs that had these ridiculous salaries, not having any expenses, and save $500,000 in a few years. And go home and buy a house at the time when people were going through, you know, the worst recession since the Great Depression.
Can you describe what it was like at its peak with all that money washing around? What was it like to be in Kabul?
I mean, you could just show up, and if you had a pulse and could speak English, you could find a great job. And for journalists, I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money because I was a sort of freelancer who was just getting started in his career. But, you know, it was really easy to get work. The whole world's attention was on Kabul. So it was a real adventure. And on weekends, there'd be these debaucherous parties where everyone was blowing off steam and sort of consequence-free zone with this very heightened sense of self-importance because they're at the center of world events. It was the place where every ambitious aid worker, diplomat, and journalist wanted to be.
Is part of the reason why foreign workers and Westerners are being targeted is this resentment and this blowback from this excess?
Well, I don't think that's why the Taliban is doing it, but now there's a separate phenomenon that I talk about in the piece. And you may have heard, your listeners may have heard about something called green on blue or insider attacks, which have been a huge problem for the American military. And what they are is when Afghan soldiers or police have suddenly turned their guns on their American trainers or partners. And this was a big source of casualties at the peak in 2012. They had to dramatically scale back their plans to train the army and police as a result of it. And a lot of these attacks weren't happening because the individual in question was secretly a member of the Taliban. It was just because they had gotten into dispute. There had been some sort of cultural resentment. You know, it was a bit mysterious, in fact. And a few of the attacks that have happened, including possibly this Swedish journalist that we mentioned who was shot in the street, seem like they might be the same kind of attacks. And there is a tremendous amount of resentment toward Westerners in Afghanistan and Kabul. They've seen all the money come and go, and it's only benefited a very small elite lavishly. And so I think that there is this wider sense that we've worn out our welcome that is related to that kind of excess.
So as the West withdraws and the United States prepares to evacuate, remove all the military there, or at least most of it, what's going to happen now? Who's going to fill the vacuum? Is it going to be the Taliban?
You're also going to see more fragmentation, I think, in the Afghan government. You know, there's a lot of like warlords and militias that were never really properly integrated into the Afghan government. They were sort of bought off with foreign money. And so these groups, I think, will be increasingly emboldened to defy the central government and take part in opium trafficking or other forms of the illicit economy in the provinces. So I think you're going to see, and we're already seeing, you know, this is in terms of the number of civilian casualties, the war is getting more and more violent. People are looking at Iraq right now and wondering what's in store for the Afghan state. There are some obvious differences, but I mean, I can remember when I would go on embeds with the U.S. military here, a lot of the trainers who were training the Afghan army would complain and say that the Iraqi army was much better and easier to work with and had a higher level of education and professionalism. So it remains to be seen whether the Afghan army can hold up and defend the government against the Taliban, which has not gone away, which has outlasted the surge and which is waiting.
Matthew Akins, magazine writer based in Kabul. His latest story, Last Tango in Kabul, is in the current issue of Rolling Stone. Coming up, Matt Weiner is here to talk about making his movie, Are You Here? It's a comedy starring Zach Galifianakis and Owen Wilson. More Groundhog Day than Mad Men after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. AMC's Mad Men is up for 3 Emmys tonight, including one for Outstanding Drama. The show's creator, Matt Weiner, is hoping to break a 2-year losing streak in that category. But he has more on his mind these days than just the small screen. Matt Weiner has a new feature film in theaters now called Are You Here? It stars Owen Wilson and Zach Galifianakis. Owen Wilson plays an immature, aimless TV weatherman who often shows up to work stoned. Here he is getting dressed down by his boss after making a dirty joke during a live broadcast.
You think you're irreplaceable? You have this job because you're handsome and you can talk.
And people trust me.
No one trusts you. You think you're going to move to a bigger market? Not with that nose.
You know, I could just as easily demean your job if I had any idea what it entailed. And honestly, I kind of resent you making this so awkward for me.
What are you talking about?
Well, I need a little money till the end of the month.
It's the 6th.
Look, I didn't say give it to me. It's just an advance.
You know, the good thing is, I know you can't go on like this forever.
Guys like you count on that. But what if you're wrong?
Owen Wilson in Are You Here? I spoke with Matt Weiner about the movie, which took years to get made, not unlike the pilot for Mad Men.
All my stuff takes a long
time. It does.
Time.
Why does it take so long?
I'm not very good on the page. I don't know. It just does. I mean, I honestly think that there's the positive version of it is that there's some level of originality to mm-hmm. it, and it's unfamiliar to people, and it doesn't have a discernible genre. Mad Men doesn't have a discernible genre. I mean, it requires people who are willing to take a risk, and sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't. But I don't think any of it looks like anything out there. And that is always something that's harder to get made.
So it was hard to get made, though, right?
I mean, the movie,
even though you are well known, especially in this town, you had to go from studio to studio trying to get it made?
Well, from the beginning, it was kind of decided that it wasn't a studio movie. And especially once the show took place, everyone realized that I might not function well in a studio environment. But that said, it was really hard. The show did not really open any doors for me in the film
was that
business, except for like, oh, yeah, it's not like I'm beating my breast or anything like that. I just think people should know that It's always hard. It's always filled with rejection. It's always a long road. I think people make it and they sort of try to sweep mm-hmm. it under the rug because rejection is embarrassing. But, you know, all of the actors on the show, on Mad Men, all of them had a long journey. Zach Galifianakis, who was in the movie, he didn't have a career when I wrote the movie. And then, you know, and he and Owen are around the same age. So it's kind of interesting.
Did you write it thinking about him?
I didn't know who he was. I had no idea. I wrote it for Owen. I really did want Owen. My fantasy version of the movie in the back of my mind was Chevy Chase and John Belushi. But Owen to me, like Bill Murray, has a kind of, he has that glib, snarky character that he plays, but he also, I think, has some depth to him. And I really wanted to play with that persona and say like, oh, you recognize him from The Wedding Crashers. You recognize this guy from those kinds of movies. But what if you took that seriously and said, oh, wait a minute, this guy is not a man-child, whatever. This guy has a drug problem. You know, that was sort of like the taking his comic persona and Zach's as well, and Amy's also, Amy Poehler, and saying like, okay, this looks like one of these movies, but you have to be prepared for the fact that it is funny, but it's a pretty serious movie. For me, I wanted to write about friendship. I wanted to write about drugs, medication. I wanted to write about the compromises of being an adult. And when you hire comedians like this, you have a chance at getting to some kind of emotional core that has sentiment but is not sentimental. And so for them to change into the positive version that you're trying to tell the story of, they have to start in a pretty yucky place. Yuckies, that's a pretty good word for it. I'm trying not to swear.
You're a dad with four boys, so you're probably used to it.
Oh, no, I got other words.
Yeah, you have four boys. What am I thinking? Well, let's talk about that because the change in Don Draper took many, many years from your perspective.
We tried to do it every season, but yeah. We tried to
do
it every
season.
Or many
hours at least. And yes. This is a two-hour movie.
Yes.
And so how was it for you in terms of dealing with the time constraints of working in a feature film versus a television series?
Well, there's the issue of resolution. I mean, that's really all it is. I didn't have a TV series yet. I'd watched a lot of TV. But part of your job on a TV show is to resolve whatever the hell you feel like. And hopefully people come back next week. And I've always, sometimes to the frustration of the audience, let a lot of stuff go. I work by the season because I never know if there's going to be another season. So we'll do 13 hours. That's the whole story. When you come back the next year, it's a whole new story.
Yeah.
I mean, you're supposed to keep track of what's happened, I guess, but it's a whole new story. This was hard to figure out how long the movie should be. And, you know, on the one hand, your instinct as an entertainer is you do want the film to come to an end and for people to wish that they could spend more time with the people, with the characters. But you really do want to take them on a journey. And I, for one, wanted to write a movie without a formula that did not look like other movies where you really wouldn't know what was going to happen. And at the same time, you know, sort of almost so much of my work is about playing against people's expectations based on what they learn from the movies. So thinking of how it would be dealt with in a movie and then thinking about how real life works, you immediately get the unexpected. And the characters are aware of the movies. So their life is unexpected. This is not what I expected. This is not how it was supposed to be. I thought we were just going to get high and have fun for the rest of our life. Wait a minute. You mean you're mentally ill? That's an unsolvable problem. And
so that's the Zach Galifianakis.
Zach Galifianakis' character, yeah. So structurally, there is a big difference between the way a movie and a TV show are structured, even by the hour. But I wanted to do something that I thought was a little bit different than that.
Before this current golden age of television, of which you're a part with Mad Men and then previously The Sopranos, television was very low compared to film, right? So if you wanted to be in this business, the holy grail was to make a feature film.
That's
right?
The film business, I think, that feels that way.
Right. But, you know, before that, it used to be seen that way. But now it seems to be the reverse, that good viewing is on the small screen, if you will, these days, that a lot
more
quality.
I don't know who has the cachet is a part of it. But, I mean, television, I don't want to be contrarian about it, but television and film have been battling each other for dominance constantly. There's an interview with Stanley Kubrick where he talks of in the 50s about Playhouse 90 and the writing on television. And they co-opted all of these TV writers. There was Rod Serling and Paddy Chayefsky and Reginald Rose and all the directors, John Frankenheimer, Sidney Lumet. The list goes on. Mm-hmm. Those were the people working in television. And he said the film business has to keep up and CinemaScope alone is not going to do it to compete with TV. That was a golden age. That was the golden age of TV. Television is current. It can be the stupidest thing in the world when it's stupid, but there's never a time when there's not something good on TV. And I always sort of like, I love the commercial. I love being part of, included in this conversation about it. To me, this is all a business reality. And the business reality is that the adult drama and the adult comedy cost too much to market and are too language and culturally specific to be part of the film business. And, you know, you take – when the Oscar movies come out, you take a look at it. Those are all made independently and picked up by the studios and distributed. They don't make those movies. They don't have the money left over after making Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever they're doing. These international – I call them almost silent movies. They are – and that's not an insult. It's just they are bonfires. They're pure, mostly formulaic – visual language that is not culturally specific. And I have four boys. I've seen them all. It's not a judgment. It's just like, make no mistake too, these companies making the feature films own the television stations also.
Right, right.
So for them, this is a diversification. You want the adult market? Send your creative people to TV. They can take a risk. They can get a smaller audience. And a lot of people who write the kind of things like The Sopranos, they have no place. They're not welcome in the feature film business because they don't write tentpole movies. But there's still an audience.
Yeah, of course. And that's, I guess, what I was trying to get at. But, of course, taking your point being accurate, that there are many golden ages of television and many good shows on. But I'm wondering for you personally if you thought, well, I really need to make a feature film because that will be me making it. Or does it not matter as much?
No, I think I hear that a lot. And I kind of, you're like instantly in a defensive position because I can't imagine, honestly, what happened with Mad Men ever happening. It is so weird. And I got to do 92 hours of it. And it's so specific. And it doesn't have any stars in it. And it's there's so many things going against it. That I don't judge what making it is. I got to shoot everything that I wrote. I got to discover so much. I got to keep doing it. I always wanted to make a film because some stories you know are a film. You just do. And some stories you know. I had many opportunities during the 7 years in which no one was interested in Mad Men. I had the most opportunities I've ever had with people reading the pilot and saying, turn this into a movie. And I knew it wasn't a movie. I knew that you couldn't reveal that Don Draper was married in the middle of the movie and have any weight or interest in it. But revealing it at the end of the pilot, you are propelled into what turned out to be a 7-year story.
In this one, this movie, Are You Here?
Yes.
You didn't think, oh, this could be a series set in small town Pennsylvania?
No, because I kind of wanted them to be, I wanted the change to be permanent. That's the end of it, you know? You know, they did a sequel to The Godfather. So, I mean, obviously no story is completely over.
Right, and many sequels. So is it a different process then than writing in a writer's room on a TV show?
In terms of
writing the script?
Yeah, I mean, there's no help on the story. I mean, the way you get the story done on a movie is you keep telling it to people. Figuring out the story on my own is hard. And I do still figure out a lot of story on my own. But the idea of going into the writer's room and seeing these people and having them like bring in their lives. It's just, you know, it's very, very rich environment. But
do you work better with other people in a room or on your own?
I don't know. I definitely need to bounce things off of other people. Other people have most frequently kept me from doing the worst ideas. And I dictate my scripts. So there's always another person, and that is a special chemistry. I've had people that have worked out and have won Emmys and become great writers on their own, and I have people that there's just no chemistry and it doesn't work. So I'm one of those people, I think, that I'm very A-U-R-A-L. Like, and I have a good memory for dialogue. I have a good memory for emotional memory for music, and I can talk my way out through things, and it keeps me from thinking too much. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's always hard to be by yourself. My joke is always that TV writing is for people who hate being alone more than they hate writing.
So are you done with movies? You can't, I mean, or is this it?
No,
or
you it depends on the idea. I definitely plan on making another movie.
Do you have a script?
No, I'm actually not planning on doing anything right now. I am going to – I've had this 14-year journey with Mad Men, 7-year journey with – 8-year journey with the movie. I am going to at least wait until the show is finished airing to even think about what I'm going to do next. I need to go back to my day job of, like, sleeping and, like, eavesdropping and, you know, daydreaming, reading.
But how can you even remember doing that? I mean, you haven't done it.
Well, I do it. I do it all the time on the show. You know, we have to do it in between seasons all the time to think about what we're going to do next on the show. But to think of something completely new and say, what is on my mind? Getting to make these projects, not just, you know, 13 one-hour movies 7 times, but making this film, I said a lot of what was on my mind right now. There's a line in Mad Men where Conrad Hilton says to Don, what do you want? You know, and Don talks about the snake that was starving for 6 months and then chokes to death on a mouse. I don't want to choke. I don't need to eat with both hands. I don't need to open up my desk drawer and take out everything I ever wrote. I kind of want to find out what's on my mind, if that sounds strange, almost like a stranger.
Well, Matt Weiner, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Madeline.
Matt Weiner, his new movie is called Are You Here? Warren Olney is here now to tell us what's on at 1 o'clock.
President Obama had such promise when it came to unifying the nation with regard to race. Is he now avoiding the issue because he has become such a polarizing figure? We'll hear what he sounded like in 2008, what he sounds like now.
Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, rockets exploding in space, the latest from out there, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Happening in the world of rocket science, Elon Musk's SpaceX launched an unmanned rocket on Friday, and it blew up. But that's not all. Over the weekend, the European Space Agency tried to put 2 global positioning satellites into orbit. They didn't blow up, but they did end up in the wrong orbit. And this morning, the U.S. Army tested its new advanced hypersonic weapon, and that blew up 4 seconds after launch. I guess it is rocket science after all. Jonathan McDowell is an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and he blogs at Jonathan's Space Report. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Good to be back, madam.
Well, let's start with SpaceX, Elon Musk's company. What happened with that rocket that blew up on Friday?
Right. Well, the first thing to understand is that this is not the rocket that launches their satellites, the one that they've really got to get right. This was a test vehicle that they were using to really push the edge of what they can do, and they were practicing going up with it and landing it back down again for reusability. And what happened was on this latest test flight, it got a little way off the pad and something went wrong, and they haven't exactly said what yet, but probably something like one of the 3 engines was not firing right, and they blew it up for range safety. So when the rocket goes off course, rather than have it careen out of control and maybe smash into bystanders, you deliberately blow it up under control. I actually don't think, although it was a spectacular video for anyone who hasn't seen it, I think they'll delay the satellite launch that they're planning for just a few days to check that there's no common problem. But I think it sounds like a fairly fixable problem for them.
Right. And the backstory is that since the space shuttle program ended, the U.S. has been dependent on Russian rockets. SpaceX is one of 3 companies that are front runners to win a multi-billion dollar, I believe, NASA contract to build American-made spaceships. So does this set back that bid on the part of SpaceX?
I don't really think so. They've already demonstrated that they can reliably send their capsule, their Dragon capsule, to the space station and recover it back from the ocean. The really critical test that's coming up later this year is of the emergency escape system that they're planning on the Dragon, because that's the thing that will qualify it for carrying people. This setback, it is a setback, but I think it's a minor one, and I don't think it will affect the forthcoming announcement of who gets the money from NASA to develop the commercial crew. And I think they're a strong, you know, front runner contender for that.
All right. So let's talk about this other thing that happened today in Alaska with the U.S. Army testing its advanced hypersonic weapon. What is an advanced hypersonic weapon, first of all?
Well, this is something that a number of countries have been playing with lately. And the idea is that rather than, you know, having to bring your aircraft carrier or your airbase near to the country that you're attacking, you can use essentially an intercontinental missile to launch a warhead across the world, have it come down into the atmosphere, glide for hundreds of miles at a low altitude, and with precision strike on a target. And so it's a sort of scary space-age weapon that is a way of using the nuclear missile technology without actually having necessarily nuclear warheads. And the Chinese actually tested a similar thing a couple weeks ago that also failed. This turns out to be tricky technology to fly very fast within the atmosphere. But the thing that went wrong with the Army test today didn't even get to that stage. It was an old Polaris missile that was meant to carry the weapon into space on its way down that blew up just off the pad. And so, you know, a very expensive, high-technology payload with a cheap old rocket that didn't get it where it was meant to go.
Why didn't they use a better rocket?
Well, you know, rockets are expensive, and I shouldn't diss the Polaris too much. It's been pretty reliable. You have all these very expensive missiles lying around, and so they're being recycled for use as delivery vehicles.
Well, tell us more about this weapon and how much damage it could cause.
You know, it's pretty secretive what they do. I think the idea, as I understand it, it's not like a nuke, which would, you know, take out a huge area. It's more a precision vehicle. It will do similar to when we now do cruise missile strikes, but you'd be able to do it without moving your forces to the area. So it's another step, like the drones, right, which are controlled remotely by people sitting in front of computers in the U.S. It's another step in moving war, turning war into a video game that you don't have to put your own people at risk. You don't have to have them leave home. And so, you know, it's not clear to me that it actually gains you any added security. It's not clear to me that it's going to be worth the expense that it's going to take. But it seems to be a direction that a number of countries are going.
Okay, let's talk about this European Space Agency issue with the satellite that went into a different orbit. What happened there?
So this is very interesting. It's a very big prestige project for the European Union to give Europe an independent GPS system. And what happened was they used this Russian rocket that appears to have delivered it to the right height, but then at the last minute when it was going to fire its rocket engine to deliver the satellites to a nice circular orbit around the Earth, it fired its rocket engine the right amount for the right amount of time, but in completely the wrong direction, and ended up putting the satellites in a completely wrong orbit that they won't be able to be part of the constellation. So the suspicion is that there was a thruster problem, so the rocket coasts for a while before it fires that rocket engine the final time, and during the coast, it tumbled instead of pointing the right direction, and so when they reignited the engine, it wasn't pointing the right way, and they didn't have a way of spotting that.
So why is this important? This is used for GPS technology, I understand.
Right. So, well, you know, we couldn't live without GPS, right? Everyone depends on it to figure out where they are. But can't we just use American GPS everywhere in the world? Well, you know, a lot of people in Europe are not comfortable with that.
Because of spying?
Because they feel like it's important for Europe to have independence in these things, to have control of its own technology. There's some concern that a future U.S. government could decide to switch off the high-precision part of GPS if there was a conflict. And so certainly as China's developing its own GPS, Russia has had its own for a long time, Europe as an entity, as it wants to take its place in the world stage, feels like it's very important not to be begging at America's table, but to have its own control over its own ability to use space and use location on the ground.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That's Jonathan McDowell. He's an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and he blogs at Jonathan's Space Report. Joy Myers is here now.
Happy Monday.
Happy first day of the week.
Yeah, unless you're going to Burning Man. Update on a Friday story we did. Burning Man is closed because of weather. They're
How
not going to open it up.
How do you Burning Man?
Well, Burning Man is a place in our minds, so you can't do that. But the actual physical manifestation out in the desert, it's a no-go until midday Tuesday because of rain. Just thought I'd give you all a heads up in case you're in your car going out there now. So as for today's show, Emmys. We talked about the Emmys at the top of the show, and I asked you all to nominate some new Emmy categories just to spice it up a bit. On our Facebook page, Mike Frizzell says there should be a category for craziest hair. Frizzell. He says the Swede from Hell on Wheels should take it hands down. Anthony Williams says there should be a Best Impassioned Monologue Award. He says Chandra Wilson's character from Grey's Anatomy would be the winner there. I think Kerry Washington would kill it for the best lip quiver category. Kevin Spacey would have the best breaking of the fourth wall performance for House of Cards. Maximilian Canepa on Instagram says there should be an Emmy for Best Awards Show. And I think that the Oscars...
Isn't there one?
Yeah, the Oscars are up for an Emmy, though I'm not sure for what category. Help me out on this, Twitter friends. Let me know what's going on there. And speaking of Twitter, Brad Foley tweeted that there should be an Emmy for Best Mic Drop at the end of a show, which is exactly what I would do right now if I was actually holding the mic. But alas, it's floating in front of my face, so no mic drops.
Plus, that's kind of expensive there, that mic. We'd have to have another fundraiser. Just be a whole host of problems. Jolie Meyer. Okay, you get best feedback person. Whoop. Yay. All right. If you want to if you want to respond to anything you hear on the air or just write in with your thoughts, share them with us. You are more than welcome. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Twitter, @KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.